Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, Broadway superstar Sam Harris on his new stage show and film, Ham, a musical memoir. That's coming up on Endeavors.
You're listening to Endeavors Radio with your host from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Dan McPeak.
Well, hello, Endeavors fans. Happy New Year. I hope everyone had a safe New Year. You were able to have some interaction with family or roommates or loved ones or whoever it was. And keep trucking, because we are slowly starting to come out the other side. Back in 2007, which was hard to believe was the early days of YouTube and social media, I remember getting my Facebook in early 2007 and had sort of, I guess, been on YouTube kind of starting the last third of 2006. And there was a lot of, back then it was all vloggers and kind of nothing else. I mean, it still is, but there's a lot more out there now. There were sort of two people I was becoming aware of who both happened to share the same name, although one was a YouTube star and one wasn't. Sam Harris. One Sam Harris you might know, is an author, neuroscientist, and member of what's sort of known as the four horsemen of New Atheism. But he's not my guest today. There's also another Sam Harris, who's been on Broadway for 30-odd years. He's a singer, he's an author, he's an actor, and he is the Sam Harris that I will be talking to today. Although, of course, if you go and look up on Wikipedia, there are four other Sam Harris's that have entries. There is a Australian basketball player named Sam Harris who has played 10 seasons in the Southeast Australian Basketball League and 2 seasons in the National Basketball League. There is a New Zealand rugby footballer named Sam Harris. There is a theater producer from the early 1900s named Sam Harris. And of course, the lead singer of the rock group X Ambassadors is also Sam Harris. But my guest today, Sam Harris the singer, got a start on Star Search in its inaugural season way back in 1983. I can't believe Star Search has been on that long. And he won it. His signature song became Over the Rainbow. And since then, he has appeared in such Broadway musicals, classics, as Grease, Jesus Christ Superstar, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, one of my favorite shows, The Producers, The Jazz Singer, Pippin, and the stage adaptation of The First Wives Club, of which he was part of the original cast out in San Diego. What's interesting about Sam is, unlike a lot of these Broadway stars who live and work in New York, Sam has spent almost all of his career in Los Angeles. And that's why that, in addition to all his Broadway shows and his accolades, he's also done some film and television. In the 1980s, he co-created the sitcom Down to Earth, and has also appeared on shows such as The Class, Rules of Engagement, CSI, and The Wayne Brady Show. He has also released 9 platinum-selling music albums, and, if that weren't enough, has also authored a couple of books. He talks about all this, as well as his friendships with Bridget Moynihan and Billy Porter, who both, in a roundabout way, helped him on his new film called Ham, A Musical Memoir, which is a film version of his acclaimed one-man stage show. It is now available to stream on Lamley Theatres, that's L-A-E-M-M-L-E, starting as of December, and starting on January 7th, it will be available for streaming and on demand. This is me with Sam Harris. Perfect. Sam Harris, hello. How are you this afternoon?
Just fantastic. I mean, considering that the world is falling apart and no one can see anyone. Other than that, it's a beautiful day here in Los Angeles, and I'm grateful that we're all healthy.
How are the restrictions over there? How's Newsom been doing with all that?
Well, we have a new lockdown, and so, but it just makes sense. You know, I mean, we just cannot keep doing what we've been doing because it hasn't been working. It's a shame that it's around Christmas, but it's probably the best time because it, you know, deters people from making poor choices. But it is what it is. It's temporary. I keep saying that. It's temporary. Yep. Temporary. And the other thing I keep saying to myself and my friends, my whiny friends, suck it up. Just suck it up. We'll get through it. It's 1 year.
I mean, you know, there's been a lot of talk about how the, you know, the weather influences, you know, your social plans, I guess. And yeah. Was it harder? You know, you're in sunny California. Was it harder to stick to the restrictions when the weather was super nice out?
Well, I mean, we can be outside. We can go to parks. We can walk on the street. We can take the dog out. We can go to the beach. We can do things that are outside. I think that you're right, that it's a weather issue. So places that you can't be outside, it's a little rougher for the mental health, you know?
Yeah. You know, and it, as someone who has made a living performing in front of the public for 30 years, how has that affected you? How do you think theater is going to be affected going now and going forward?
Well, they're saying, you know, that Broadway's not going to come back for, a year, at least another year, probably into 2022. And it's just sad. It's just sad because I think at this time we need it most. We need to have a common experience with other people and laugh and cry together and think together and, you know, have that reflection of ourselves. So I think from everything, from whatever, stand-up comics and clubs where we need to laugh at ourselves and to theater, certainly, it's gone. However, I have made that bridge, have I not, from filming my theater show and putting it out there. So even though you can't sit in a theater with other people, there are certainly advantages to film in that you get close-ups and you get a more intimate take on the show.
You know, on that note, film has been moving online. Film and television has been moving online for a while. We're seeing bands, musicians doing a lot of virtual concerts. Could virtual theater, is that a realistic thing that could happen, do you think?
I do. Ultimately, it's just the problem is it's not as simple as a band, because real, you know, theater on a production level is hundreds of people. Of stagehands and crew and, you know, lighting operators and sound people and casts and rehearsal rooms together. And so that's not, it's not possible now. However, I think that when this is over, it's changed a lot of things. That when it is safe to be together, I think that what it's done is it's given us an awareness of, wow, I don't have to be in New York City to see a show. You can buy a ticket and see it in your home. You know, I think it's opened our minds. I think the same thing is with business. You know, some law firm that has three floors of a downtown building, and they're like, you know what, I don't know if we need this. We need one floor and a conference room, and everybody can work from home and meet once a week. I think it's opened our eyes, and I'm not sure we'll ever completely return to normal. But you know, it will get better. It will get better.
How do you think art and culture will be appreciated once we come out of this? You know, when we were first starting, everyone was watching everything on Netflix, all the streaming sites, you know, and all, you know, film, Warner Brothers just made that huge announcement with HBO about how they're moving all their films online. And there's been a lot of talk about whether we should start considering art an essential service. Where are you on how you think it's going to be treated going forward?
I think art is definitely an essential service. And I think that the great empires in history have been the ones that financed and respected art, whether it be painting or, you know, theater or whatever it is. And when those empires started making other priorities and didn't invest in that and didn't create a place for it, it fails. It's essential on so many levels. It's essential. You know, it's funny, you can look back at theater and say, oh my God, that's what was happening in the country and in the world at that time. It is a social reflection, what we needed. You know, look at the 30s and the Depression, when there were all these big movie musicals that were totally escapist, you know? And then there were films that came out in the 60s when everything was very turbulent and political, and film and television and theater are a reflection of what's going on, and they're historical records of what's going on, and they are very essential. And art the same way, like painting art and sculpting, it reflects where we are. And we have to see that, you know? We have to see ourselves. And particularly when we're isolated, we have to find ourselves in whatever virtual capacity we can. And that's another reason that the timing of this, of my film, of my show, Ham, a musical memoir, is really, I think, a good time, because it is human and it is funny and it is self-deprecating and it is poignant and it is triumph over adversity. You know, that's the story. And even though the specifics might be mine, it's everybody can find themselves in it, I think, I hope.
You know, filming a theater show is nothing new, and it's not only are we consuming art in a new way, but I think we're making it in a new way. I know you were a very early YouTube pioneer influencer back in like 2007-8, I want to say. I think that's when I first remember watching your videos. How do you think technology has changed the way we express ourselves?
Well, I think there's some real pros to that and some real cons. The pros are that it gives people a means of expression for done cheaply. They can create a song in their house. They can record all the parts. They can look at other people who are, I need that bass player and he's in Victoria. I need, you know, and it can create things. The downside of that is that technology has given us all a wall of anonymity in which we feel we can do and say things that are, that we wouldn't say if we were, had to be in a room with someone. We wouldn't say those things. We wouldn't, you know, the meanness. My kid is 12 years old, he's in the 7th grade, and already there are cyberbullying incidents and things like that, and, you know, things that are disparaging or inappropriate. So I think the pros outweigh the cons. I think that also, like in my film, again, and I keep referring to it because that's why we're here, but I went through a troubled, you know, I had a teenage attempted suicide. And that's because when you are in that kind of place, you think you're alone. You think you're the only person and no one else gets it. And you decide that it's almost like a, for me, it was like a friend. It was like this idea of something that could save me if nothing else could save me. Meanwhile, now we can reach out to anybody and everybody. We are, nobody is alone. Whatever your issues are, nobody is alone. There's always help. There's always someone else to guide you down the path. And that's really an extraordinary thing that I don't think we had before. And I, again, particularly in this time of isolation, when people are depressed and people are drinking more and people do feel outside, we can connect, you know?
You mentioned, of course, Ham, a musical memoir. I just had the privilege of watching it. And I know it started off as an actual nonfiction book. Right. Was it always part of the plan that you were going to adapt it for the stage? And how would you compare writing, you know, a book to creating something for a live audience?
Well, I think that my live shows, other than doing other people's shows, theater, my own concerts through the years, which are very theatrical and have a theatrical arcs and places and structure, I think it informed writing the book because I know my voice. I know the way I think and speak and my humor and all that. But no, I had, when I wrote the book, I had no intention of it turning into a musical play. And I was, when I was promoting it, rather than do it in bookstores where you go and do readings, typically things like that, you know, I did it in theaters and in auditoriums. And I took my music director of many, many years, and I would read a story from the book. And then I would sing something that was related to somehow. And when I was doing it in New York, two producers approached me and said, do you want to develop this? Do you want to make it into something? And this amazing woman, Susie Dietz, got behind this so hard. And I, as I said, I live in LA, and so does Todd, my music director. So we went to New York and worked with my friend Billy Porter, whom you may know from Pose and everything. He's like this fashionista too. And he's a brilliant man, not just as an actor and singer, but also as a dramaturge and a director. So we developed it with Billy, and he directed the New York production. Then I came to LA and had a different director, and it just got larger. It got to be a full production. And then we shot it at this gorgeous theater, the Pasadena Playhouse. But no, I didn't imagine that, but it seemed really natural once it started happening. It's kind of where I live, you know? And because it was autobiographical, the difference in the book is it's a collection of essays that are not chronological. It's personal stories, show business stories, family stories. But in the play, of course, it's chronological. And then we started writing original material for it, original songs, and then use a lot of songs that people know. So it became this nice little mishmash. I'm glad you saw it.
The folks over at October Coast are always very good in sending me screeners and materials, because you have a lot of, you know, yay, big spectacle songs, right? And then you have a lot of songs that are, you know, a little more ballads. And so does the time in your life or the specific moment in your life that you're talking about, you know, for example, with the Darning Needle or with the Seek and All, does that influence the type of song that you're going to create for that moment?
Absolutely. In a musical, a song should always move the plot forward. It should always start somewhere and end somewhere that is different. Otherwise, it's just a commentary on something you've seen. It needs to go forward. And, you know, there's an old saying, this like, why do people sing a song on a show? Well, it's because words are not enough. And then why do they dance? Because a song is not enough. And so it's an artful magnification of what's happening in the plot for that. So in that scene that you're talking about, there's a song that after I've taken the second all, where I'm actually falling asleep and singing this song called Sweet Dreams, which is about having, for those, I'm eager for you guys who are watching to see this, but it becomes after I was 16 and I fell in love with a boy, which at the time in the culture and in a Bible Belt, Oklahoma, and was so, you know, taboo, so wrong. And I had realized that I would never, at the time I thought, have a normal life, be an open, happy person, be able to share my life with anyone or the world or my parents or anyone. And having experienced that, that's when I decided this wasn't worth it to be here. And so this song actually, instead of it being a woe is me song, it is the place where I am saying I had love, and so I'll sleep with sweet dreams because I loved you. You changed me. You gave me a different point of view. So it's ironic that in this moment of dying, that I am singing basically a love song saying it's okay. It's okay, because I don't think very many people have had this feeling, this love. So yes, the songs are always move the plot forward and are a reflection. And the scenes will tell you what those are. Something Billy Porter did, was because I had these stories, and he would say, go home and write the scene. I don't want to hear the story. I want you to play it. And that's why I ended up playing 12 different characters. It's like, write the dialogue. You don't have to be glued to what's just in the book. That's the blueprint. So that's you know, how the theater was created, the musical.
You mentioned you play 12 different characters, and for the most part, you're still telling it in first person as yourself. But I know when you played Jerry, your sort of first manager, you shift the perspective to him, and you start referring to yourself in the third person as yeah. as Sam. What went into you for that change in perspective? Why did you feel that was the best way to tell that period of your life?
Well, Jerry was my primary mentor and teacher of everything about creativity, about authenticity. And it became a device because, and by the way, the real Jerry is not like, you know, vaudeville. He was funny, he's very Jewish. So I was able to use that kind of rhythm, but it became a theatrical device. And it was also that Jerry could say things about me that I could not say about myself. You know, it's like you, Dan, are supposed to tell me how fabulous my movie is because I can't say that, even though I think it.
Right.
So he became a device to be able to narrate that period of my life that I did the TV show, that I did Star Search, and, you know, overnight had a was recognizable and things really changed. So he was able to tell that story as himself in this sort of vaudeville shtick. And then, as you know, it cuts back and forth to me singing the songs on some of the songs I did on that TV show, and how the stakes got higher and it got larger and bigger and more important, and what happened in my life. So it was like this switch in time.
One thing I didn't realize is right after you did Star Search, you created a show for television.
Yeah.
Down to Earth. And Where did that come up? Was television, did you go to LA because you wanted to be on television before Broadway, or how did how did Down to Earth come to be?
You know, there is something wonderful about really youthful ignorance. Nobody tells you can't do something. Nobody says that's not possible because you can. I was talking about tooting your own horn. You can. When you're 20 years old, you can say, I remember I used to go when I was playing these nasty little clubs, and I would go up to somebody and say, you should come see me. I'm really good. I think you'll really like it. You know, you could do that. You can't do that when you get older. And I think with the show, my best friend was Bruce Newberg, and we co-created a musical, a big musical. And we just really worked great as a team. And through a connection, we were able to pitch this show, which ran for 4 years. And it was the first original programming that TBS had done. It was a sitcom. And I didn't know it should be hard. I didn't know that you just don't do that. We don't write a series when you're 22 and somebody buy it. So I just thought everything should happen like that. I have since learned that is not true. I have a TV show actually now in development that was really moving and going, and then COVID hit and just threw it on its ass. So now we're retooling and redoing, and you often hear stories, even from huge people, like whatever, Martin Scorsese, it's like, oh, that took 10 years to make that, to get that movie made. It's like, what? You're Martin Scorsese. And the book, I have a new book, Dan, called The Substance of All Things. It's fiction, it's my first literary fiction. I'm really proud of it. It just came out a couple of months ago and it's doing great. And the reviews have been so sensational, but that was a 4 year writing process to write the book. You know, these things take time.
I was going to ask about that since you brought it up. The Substance of All Things, two questions, I guess. Is it, you know, obviously Ham is true. Is there a different mindset when you're writing something that's true versus something that's made up?
Absolutely. But when you're writing fiction, everything is based on something or some version that you know, a character, a quirk, a physicality, in my new book, it's set in rural Oklahoma, where I was born, in the 60s. It's a little bit time off from my actual childhood, but I know what that smells like. I know what that looks like. I know what the culture is. I know what the church is. So yeah, it's a different mindset, but it all comes from something. You know, even though it's not completely accurate, it's influenced certainly by that.
Given your background, do you think we'll see some sort of adaptation of The Substance of All Things, whether it's theater or film in the future?
Dan, it is such a movie. It is such a movie. It plays, reads like a movie. It plays a movie, and I totally see that. That's definitely on the big list. But right now, the book came out, so I'm promoting the book. We're getting it out there. The response has been great. And then, you know, when we went with Global Digital as our distributor, they've been so incredible about getting this movie noticed. And you were talking about Warner Brothers and HBO, Lemily Theaters, which is an art chain of theaters all over the country, is now going virtual. So we get to be a part of that big launch, and it's great. And the other thing, Dan, is that show, you've having seen it, is so freaking hard to do. I'm exhausted watching it. And to do it, it required so much physical stamina, vocal stamina, emotional wroughtness. And it was hard. When I was doing the production in New York and then in LA, it's what I call a prison show. We literally can't do anything else except the show. Everything is about that. And when you have a kid, that makes it difficult. That show fried me. So now it's like, I don't got to do that anymore. It's on film.
I don't think people realize just how funny you are. I mean, I found you very funny watching this show. When you're talking about your own life, and especially times in your life that can be traumatic, where do you find the humor in that?
Well, comedy is tragedy with a twist. We laugh at ourselves, at situations. I don't want to give any spoilers or anything, but in that scene that we have referred to a couple of times, and I'm glad you mentioned funny, because the show is by and large entertainment and funny. You know, and then there are these darker moments. But something, you know, I guess, there's a lot of self-deprecation in this. And because I have to make fun of myself. And if I didn't have humor, I don't think I would have survived in anything, particularly career. My kid, as I said, is 12. And when he was born, I wished for two things, health and humor. Because if you've got health, well, that's obvious. But if you've got humor, if you can laugh at yourself and laugh at the world and find a place to twist things, it's the greatest survival tool, truly. Don't you find?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, you were raised in Sand Spring, Oklahoma, I believe, if I have that name correctly, which has neither sand nor springs, as you like to point out. But, you know, and I'm from the West Coast of Canada, but it strikes me that, at least for me, there's a certain, I guess, culture or lifestyle that's associated with Southern upbringing. How do you think that has influenced you as an artist?
Well, it was great to grow up in a little town. Everybody knew everybody. And because I was really driven, I was really fortunate, Dan, because I knew what I loved and what I wanted to do when I was like, you know, two or three. I just knew. And I had parents that really supported that, those wishes, and helped me achieve what was possible in that little town. And, you know, I was bossy and I was driven, and I would, Bright Star direct my own little productions, and it was great in that way. Meanwhile, I did always sort of resent a little bit that I didn't grow up in New York City, that I didn't grow up where I had access to see more things. And of course, the downside, the upside of a little town is it's comfortable and you know everybody. The downside is that you know everybody. You know, so it has that. And I wasn't somebody that really adhered to the rules and to the culture and to the belief, especially of the fire and brimstone church thing. I just never got it. It never resonated with me. And I would get into arguments at a very young age. I got out, I left when I was 15. And I took a lot of great stuff with me. But I knew that I needed to go to find my tribe, you know?
If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me explain. It's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or your computer. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. You can make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
You talk about the church, and yet there's also a very poignant scene where your friend invites you. I think she invites you to a church, and you hear gospel music. And even among people who aren't religious or believers, there's something very, I think, theatrical about gospel music. You know, even as someone who wasn't a churchgoer, what kind of role did gospel music play on your early career?
Well, I did have to go to church when I was a little kid. I mean, my mom would take me, my dad didn't go, and we went until a certain age. But what happened was when my friend Rochelle took me to the Black church, and I heard that music, which was so different from music in the white church, which is very controlled and very pristine and very, and you get into a Black church where it is raw and hopeful and celebrational, and yet about change, about surviving, about we will overcome, which I think appealed to me on a personal level because that's how I felt. I felt like somebody, as a secretive gay boy, little kid. I wasn't that little. I was 15 or 16, 15 when I heard that. And it spoke to me. And the freedom from which I heard that music, and it, you know, it appealed to me because as a little kid, I was always into a lot of Black pop music. And so it appealed to me on many, many levels, including, I think, a spiritual level. You know, I didn't just completely divorce myself from it. I just was never into the fire and brimstone. I'm about the love, baby.
You know, you mentioned Billy Porter, who, you know, especially in recent years, has a Broadway actor who has made a successful transition into television, which we don't always see just because they're very different mediums. But I know you've had experience on some sitcoms. You mentioned Down to Earth, but I know you're also on The Class and Rules of Engagement. Talk about your career trajectory since you've largely stayed in the theater, but you've had a little bit of experience. What went into that for you when you decided this is something that I want to experience? And how different did you find TV and the film world from live theater?
Well, a lot of it is very similar, particularly a half-hour sitcom that's shot, that's multi-camera and shot in front of a live audience, because what happens is you do a scene and the writers get together after the scene has been shot and they rewrite something or change a line or come, and they come to you and say, try this, do this, do this. And so you have to be spontaneous and improvisational and take in this new material. My theater history really helped me with that because you don't have time to mess around. You know, you have to put it in, and it really relies on your fundamentals of comedy. But as a medium difference, it is very different. It's smaller. It's more intimate. You don't have to reach the back row because the back row is all these dings, sorry, because the back row is in your face. But I do find also from my theater experiences when I'm not just doing a play, but when I'm doing my own concerts. That is small in many ways. That, let me turn this off. That is small. That is intimate. And you must tell the truth. You must tell the truth. There's no faking it or phoning it in, especially in a camera situation. It's right in your face. And with Ham, we shot two shows live in front of a live audience without stopping. I think one time I stopped to change shirts. But then the next day we did a pickup day so the camera could be on the stage and be right here during more intimate scenes. And there is a difference in the way you play it because it's about this and it's about this, you know?
We mentioned your film, Curran. I know one film that you starred in that didn't get a lot of love but had a really good cast, at least I think, was In the Weeds. You had Bridget Moynihan, you had Ellen Pompeo before she blew up. Yeah. And I know you've also worked on two films with Nicole Kahn, which we'll get to in a minute. Yeah. But a film like that, that Into the Weeds, just working with those powerhouses, do you have any memories of that?
Oh, God, yes. Well, first of all, Bridget and I met on that show and were immediately brother and sister. And I think part of it is she's so gorgeous. She's like freakily, I'm not straight. And I would just sort of like just study her and go, oh my God, you're so, over. And so everybody kind of, when you're that gorgeous, people treat you differently, I think. I wouldn't personally know, but people treat you differently. And I was super safe and we were funny together. And the circumstances of shooting that, we shot a lot of it in Brooklyn and in a restaurant. And so we didn't even have trailers for dressing rooms. We were like, and there was this like some room that there were sheets up and it was flooding and there were rats. And so talk about turning tragedy into comedy, but it was such a great team of people and a really great cast. And man, oh, I loved doing that. And you know, nobody knows this because they wouldn't, but we did a TV show was spawned from that where we shot the pilot and it didn't go. But what a great workplace environment, you know, in a restaurant with all the, and for those who don't know, In the Weeds as a restaurant term, I guess it applies to other things too, for like I'm up to here and I've got 12 tables and I'm doing this and that and, you know, but yeah, it was a ball. And Bridget and I are still remain so close. I was her birth partner in her when her son was born. I was in the room and singing in her ear and making her laugh and slept on the floor in her hospital. And I officiated her marriage to this great guy, Andrew. So, and she's like so important to, in my son's life. So it's a, I'm grateful for that movie.
And I did notice that along with a couple other names, she's thanked in the credits for Ham. Was she involved, like was she a financial contributor? How did she become involved in some way in this project?
She was a financial contributor, but she was also a rock for me when this was being developed and when it went from one form to another.
Yeah, and another person I noticed who was in the credits, and this, you know, you talked a lot about I Love Lucy in your show, and then I see one of the contributors is Lucy Arnaz. That must have been a pinch me moment.
Well, I've known Lucy for a long, long time, and we've done a million benefits together, and she's amazing. I mean, she's truly a talent. She talk about a storyteller. She's the real deal, but she's also a mensch. She's also a real person. And when I first came up and I was like after Star Search, when I was getting all this attention, I got really fortunate because a lot of the people that had so influenced me, all of a sudden I was hearing from them or they were asking me to do something. And Lucille Ball was a fan and asked me to sing at this tribute to her. And then she took me to lunch and gave me advice about the business. And she was iconic to all of us. But to me, I mean, I learned so much of my humor and certainly physical comedy from her. So there were a lot of those kind of people. I was lucky. I was never as attracted to the celebrities that were my age, that were my peers, as I was to, you know, the sort of legendary icons.
One other person that I noticed in the credits that I want to bring up, because she started in one of my favorite shows forever, Criminal Minds, Kristen Vanjness. I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
Yes.
How did you two come into contact?
Can I tell you something? I've never met her. She she heard about the thing. She saw the show. She wanted to see it become a film. And she was a financial contributor to this movie. I mean, I've said hello. We've met, but we've never even had lunch.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan. Huge fan.
One other person that I realized that was in the weeds, who I think if you're of my generation, I mean, I was born in the late 80s, but you grew up in a lot of 80s movies. Molly yeah. Ringwald, you know, who was like queen. She was like queen of the 80s. And now she's transformed herself into a lot of other roles. But working with her, especially at that point in her career, do you have any great memories of that?
Well, she's another one that was just I think when you're thrown into a situation that isn't all separate and everybody has their trailers and nobody's, you know, when you're sort of in the weeds together, real things happen and personal things happen. And she's just a great person and certainly understands the ups and downs of show business. And then there was another play that we were supposed to do together, and it didn't all come together, but I love working with her. She's great. And it's so fun for me to work with people that, you know, that I've admired, and I get to learn from them. And they're the people who've stayed around are the ones who are the most generous. They're the ones, like sometimes when you're doing a film or something, when it's one camera and you do the reverse, call the reverse. So it's over this show, it's over that. And very often there are some actors who will not read with you when the camera's not on them. The stage manager steps in, a PA steps in, and they read. And so you're acting with not the actor. But the people, the real greats and the real people who have the real stuff and want the best are the most generous. And Molly's one of those.
We did mention Criminal Minds briefly, and you got to experience sort of the whole world of the procedural drama, which was, you know, exploded in the 90s and 2000s when you appeared on CSI, I believe it was.
Yeah.
The original. What was it like for you stepping into that world? And this was already a hugely established show at that point.
Well, I'm going to say the same thing about those people, because it's very easy when you're a regular on a show that has been going on for years and years, and every single week you have guest stars that you know you're never going to see again. And there are people who are like, yeah, whatever, go on. And then there are people who engage with you because they know that if you're, it's all about the environment. And if you're in a productive environment that is kind and gracious, and what do you need? What do you need? And you create that kind of generosity, that's a great experience. It's when you get into the ones that they don't perceive you as vital or important or even much of an addition, so you don't get the time of day. But I would say that more people are not that way, because it's a when you are a regular in a show, it is a family. It is a cast of family. And so if the vibe is cool on the set, it just makes everything better.
One thing that I really enjoyed watching Ham was the baseball analogy you kept using. I'm a Canadian, but I'm a huge, huge baseball fan. What was it about, I guess, I mean, obviously growing up in the States, baseball is huge. But do you see, I guess, any correlation or relationship between baseball and athletics and being in the theater, just in terms of the drive people have to succeed?
Well, yeah. And I'm not really a sports fan, as you know, from watching Ham. I was one of the only people, I'm sure, in the history of Little League who didn't make the team. How can you be 8 and not make the team? How can someone do that to an 8-year-old? Anyway, I didn't care. But the correlation is, it's very funny. It's like when you're doing a show 8 times a week, if you're doing a Broadway show, And people are like, oh my God, you're so lucky. You only have to work 2 or 3 hours a day, 2 or 3 hours a night. It's like saying to someone, you know, oh, you're so lucky. You only have to play a football every couple of few days for just a few hours. Your whole life is about that. And in a show that's as exhausting as Ham, you really do have to be a bit of an athlete. You have to be in shape. You have to maintain, you know, voice is a little dime-sized muscle. And so, and you know, you don't want to miss. And when you're doing your own show, you can't miss. So I think the correlation and the drive and the want, and I think also in a situation in which you are performing either as an athlete or as an actor or a singer, you do, that tribe is very, very important, whether it's your team or your cast, and you work for and with each other.
Is, you know, in a city such as LA where there are, you know, 20 million sports teams, is it hard to not be a sports fan in that town?
Not remotely. I don't even know the names of the teams. The only times that I've been to a baseball game have been when I've been singing the national anthem.
Fair enough. You know, you talk about this idea of drive, and it strikes me that when you were talking about your childhood in Oklahoma, I think part of your success stems from the fact that you were so driven as a kid to get there. Does having drive correlate to having success?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. You have to want it more than anything. And you have to be able to fail. You have to be able to try things and fall on your face. You have to be able to experiment and define who you are. And but worth that work ethic, it's just vital. I have so many show injuries, Dan. I've had a hip replacement, 2 knee surgeries, a rotator cuff surgery, all show accidents, speaking of the NFL, all show accidents. And it's because you keep working on the injury. You keep like, I can't miss the show. I can't. And I think for people who are driven, whatever it is, if they love math and they're obsessed with it and they want to do it, I think it's key to everything. And I think it's, some ways it's more important than talent, because there have been people who are mediocre talent-wise, but damn it, they have to do it. They show up, they study their craft, they do everything they can, and they can find success. Now, when somebody has both, then it's a real knock out of the park. Or when somebody just has talent, but they don't invest, they wait for somebody to call them, it ain't gonna happen either. It requires drive, for sure. Which is exhausting as you get older.
How then do you define success? And do you look at it differently now than you did, say, when you won Star Search?
Oh, for sure. I think when I was really young, success was defined by how many people love you. It was defined by how many people bought your record, or was that sold out, or what did the review say? You know, it was all outside in. And I think as one grows older and does more things, the success comes from what you have invested and what you've created. You know, it's like, I have I've mentioned my kids in seventh grade, and I noticed, you know, the grades, for instance, if he just got straight A's across the board and it meant nothing, it was like so easy for him, it doesn't mean as much as if he gets that B, but he really worked for it. You know, that's who we want him to be. So it is about that drive and that investment.
You know, you've mentioned your son a few times, and I love the very end where you go back into your bedroom, and we all think that you've gone back to your childhood, and then you're talking to your dad, and then you say Cooper's name, and you're like, aw. When you first became a father, how much did you look back on your own childhood and your relationship with Bill, and how did that influence of saying, I want to do this or I don't want to be this type of father?
That's tricky because my father and I had a lot of relationship issues during the years. And it wasn't until Cooper was born that his true benevolence really came out. And he, in the play, as you know, he says, you're going to be a better father than I was. And I learned a lot from him. He introduced me to music in ways that no one else could have. He introduced me to great performers and would take me to concerts and things. We used to play this amazing game where he would put on a classical music and then say, close your eyes and tell me the story, as if my imagination was being underscored by the music. And what that did for me was it taught me that music is alive and it does create that. It creates that thing, that emotion, that imagination and the impact of it. He did a lot of great things. He wasn't, he was very, very supportive. I say was, he died a year ago. He was very, very supportive, but it was always with a bit of a judgment. It was never quite good enough. It was always, and I think that might have had something to do with my drive about proving myself, about I believed that nothing was enough. Nothing was enough. And I think it's because it wasn't really ever enough in my father's eyes. And he would celebrate me to other people. I remember once I was doing a concert in Tulsa, which is the nearest bigger town to Sand Springs. And it had been a great success and it was a huge production. It was so wonderful. And we all went to dinner after. Me and the backup girls, my music director and my family. And I had gone to the bathroom. And when I came back, my mom said, Bill, tell him what you were saying. Bill, tell him what you were. He was bragging about me and talking about how brilliant I was and how much it meant. And he looked at me and he said, the bass player was out of tune in the third song. And like, really? That's all you can come up with? So there's a friend of mine, a brilliant actor, Frank Langella, said something to me once that I really believe in. He called it the second kiss syndrome, in which at a very young age, you get that one kiss, that one stamp of approval, that one thing from your father, and you spend the rest of your life trying to get the second kiss, be it from the parents or lovers or audiences. And he was saying so many of us who have chosen show business, it's because of the first kiss syndrome. We are looking for that love and that approval and that acknowledgement. I think it's true for me.
You know, on that note, how do you think fatherhood has affected you creatively? And are you now trying to get the first kiss of approval from your son rather than from your father?
I'm not trying to get the first kiss syndrome from my son. It's not about me. Forever, it was about me and my husband, Danny. And we came to a place where our lives were good and rich. And we decided to take the step up to have the new level of what love can be. And it's more, it's everything now. You were talking about change in perspective. You know, it's much larger. It's loving beyond a capacity that I ever thought I could. And so he's everything. My family, my husband and my son are the priority above all everything. And now my work is what I do more than who I am. You know, I mean, it is who I am, but emotional well-being is not reliant upon it, because my focus is my family.
Two things quickly I wanted to touch on. There's a very powerful moment at the end where you're singing Right or Wrong, this is who I'm supposed to be, or something like that. Have you when was the last time you thought about who you were supposed to be, or and has that changed from when you were young? You know, you had this big idea of what being a star was, and until now.
I think that in being a father and teaching my child that whoever you are is who you, I want you to be a good citizen. I want you to have a good work ethic. I want you to invest in your life. I want you to be kind. He has a sign a poster in his room that says, be kind, be kind, be kind. And so that That's the difference now, that my focus is on when I see in him that nothing is wrong with you. And I always thought something was wrong with me. Always thought something was wrong with me. And when I see my son and I know that as a father, I can say to him, there is nothing wrong with you. That also helps me too, you know, physician, heal thyself. It's where I am now. And fatherhood's changed me, of course, in every way.
And finally, because I know you got to run off, but I remember becoming aware of you at the same time I was becoming aware of another sort of public figure named Sam Harris, the author and neuroscientist. I'm just curious, have you ever been confused for the other Sam Harris?
I have had things where people post things on like Facebook or something that they're usually very angry because he can be controversial. And they're right. Well, how can you say this? And how can you believe that? And, I really hope you have the wrong person. So that has happened. Yes. Or people have bought my books and say, and they write a review and like, well, I thought this was by the other Sam Harris, but I'm really glad I got it.
Sure enough. Well, the new film is Ham, a musical memoir starring Sam Harris. It's out. It's a brilliant film. I encourage all listeners to see it. And you also have a novel out, The Substance of All Things.
Dan, where can they see this movie?
Ham, a musical memoir. Yes. It is online now, isn't it?
Yes. At Lemely. L-A-E-M-E-L-L-E or something like that. Yes, you can watch it that way. And then in January, it's going to be on Broadway HD. For it also an exclusive period, and then it'll be wider. But right now it's at Lemely, and if you can somehow put that information up, because I don't know how to get anybody. I don't know.
Yeah, I will. I can.
Okay.
I'll put that in the show notes as we like to call it. The one page, I guess, you know, to use a broad term. Sam Harris, thank you so much. This has been great. This is a real treat.
I really, really enjoyed it. Thank you so much, Dan. Be well.
Thank you. You too. Take care. Have fun with your family.
Will do. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye. And that was my conversation with longtime Broadway performer, singer, actor, author, Sam Harris. His new film is Ham, a musical memoir, a film version of his acclaimed one-man show. It is out now on Lamley Theaters. That's L-A-E-M-M-L-E. And it will be available for on-demand and streaming starting January 7th. Also, be sure to check out his book, The Substance of All Things. You heard us talk about CSI a little bit. Coming up on the show next week, I will be speaking with CSI original cast member Gary Durden, who played Warwick Brown. He's in a new film called Redemption Day, so stay tuned for that. That does it for me today. Be sure to subscribe to Endeavors on Apple, Spotify, Google, Deezer, or wherever you get your podcasts. We are also available on Mnet Radio Mission. Social media is at Endeavors Radio, or you can visit the website endeavorsmedia.com. Thanks for tuning in. I will see you next time. Goodbye for now.
I just like to have a lot of sex.